Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
It's all about the macro productions.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macro aggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macro Aggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rumble, Band.video, Vigilante TV, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate your amazing and continued support as we march towards 10 million downloads. If you want to connect with me, macroaggressions.io is the place to do that. You can find information about the books, the podcasts, the news sites like Activist Post and Natural Blaze. We appreciate our sponsors. We got good ones, man. We got the best ones out there. Chemical Free Body from the beginning. Tim James has been with us. Green 85. Are you on it yet? You got to get on it. It'll change your life. The Detox Bundle is a 90-day program. I'm not kidding. You want to see results and you want to give yourself 90 days? Do that. Do the Detox Bundle. Green 85, a handful of capsules in the morning, you're good. It's transformative. Also, he has something called the Water Hero that I think everybody probably needs to take a look at. If you're somebody that has like a Berkey or a Clearly Filtered or something like a little pitch, handheld pitcher, you might want to check out the Water Hero. It's a structured water product. It will reimagine water for your entire house if you need it. So something to consider. Go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. Do a little shopping. See what you find over there. Also, our big thanks to Van Man. Vanman.shop. Have you gone there yet? You got to go to this place. Check it out. They sell fantastic toiletries that aren't filled with a bunch of chemicals. Imagine that you can get deodorant that isn't filled with aluminum, or you can get tooth powder that isn't filled with fluoride, or you can get the vanilla body butter that's ingredients are grass-fed beef tallow, shea butter, olive oil, honey, and vanilla oil, and that's it, and not a bunch of other stuff. So, I don't know. Vanman.shop is the place to go. Check it out. Go over there. Get yourself some soap. Get yourself some deodorant. And I can't have you out there smelling like a savage. Go to vanman.shop, promo code MACRO on your way out the door. Well, ladies and gentlemen, fresh out of the institution, the insane asylum, our friend, author, now adding to his list of titles, author, Eric Hollerbach. How are you, Eric?
Hi, Charlie Cook, Tyler Robinson. How are you? Boy, you're...
I am not. I was... There were a couple of my name was having quite a field day in the old algorithm. I'm sure there for a while.
It was like, Miley Cyrus, Justin Bieber, Panic Attack, you know, and then Charlie Kirk, Tyler Robinson. So, you know, you were like right up there with like things that kids are Googling, these TikTok dances, right up there.
Yeah.
How'd that feel? Was that weird? Did you feel like you were being trolled by the algorithms?
There was an article I read where the way the sentences were lined up, above it and then the words, you know, that flowed down onto the second sentence below it, it lined up in a way that made it say Charlie Robinson. If you looked at it like with your eyes squinted, I was like, this is probably not good. I'm imagining there's some sort of, I don't know, patient spell being cast on me or something. It's probably some kind of word magic that's it's like not exact. It's kind of half-assed, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, so I've done some voodoo. So if you check out, I'm here promoting my book, Girls and the Demon's Deal. I did some voodoo, but I stuck to candle magic, you know. You can stick to candle magic or, you know, you got to fly in some guy from Haiti who's going to, like, mess up your apartment. And, you know, is he going to fly a commercial plane in a loincloth and then he's going to kill chickens and you're going to lose your security deposit? So, like, I would just recommend if you're in the voodoo game, just stick to candles. You know, it's a little bit more appropriate.
Yeah. You and I talk. I didn't know you were writing a book.
Yeah,
Was it undercover? Did you just kind of do what I did with my octopus book, which is like try not to tell anybody about it and just kind of quietly write it, or what was going on?
Well, what happened was the Macro Aggressions podcast interviewed a sweet boy called Brandon Thomas. Do you know about this guy? So he said,
I'm familiar with Brandon Thomas. He is sweet, isn't he?
So he said he was starting a publishing company, and this really abusive person called Klaus Schwab Jr. Started getting texts from him on Instagram. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and all of a sudden, I drove up to the donkey ranch that he lives on. He lives on a ranch of donkeys. This is true. And I went up there and met him several times. And I had basically wrote 90% of this book at the University of New Orleans. And then I kind of was this side project that was just like, it started, you know, when you're in college, I was for screenwriting, but I was also taking like nonfiction writing workshops. And I had this crazy roommate from Dubai, and I just started like writing articles about the things he was getting into, which were hilarious. And like, it just started bleeding into my homework. So I showed my roommate a photograph of tigers, and he's like, oh, that's my friend Azamat. And I go, yeah, he just has tigers in his backyard in Dubai. And he's like, oh, yeah, sir. Well, one of the lions like killed a maid, but you never run from a lion. And just I was like, what and who and why and where? And so I just kind of started then kind of going back. I had some, challenges when I was a teenager. And then from the frustration, in my opinion, of being the best screenwriter in the world, and I've written like hilarious screenplays, if Anthony Weiner were to be president and the amount of sexual blackmail that goes on, it's like, let's just put that all on the screen. I'm tired of the MKUltra network being in the shadows. What's that day to day? So it's, yeah.
Did you write Anthony Weiner the musical, or what exactly are we talking about here?
I was on your podcast 171. I talked about it, Bonesman of the NSA. And it's just like this character called Dick Weiner, who every time he has a sex scandal, his Google hits go up, you know? And so, but he's shameless about it. He's like, yeah, I did that. What's up? And so like he has this grassroots effort of, you know, brothels, sex shops, local perverts just start sort of organizing around him. And then meanwhile, he's in Washington at that level being a pervert. And so you just kind of see how the degeneracy bleeds from the Pentagon level to the Main Street level. And and I also wrote a book called Kill the Bankers about a banker having a crisis of conscience, derivative financial swapping, and joins a vegan co-op. So I've written like really fun movies, and just from my frustration, I'm like, let me just kind of like touch on what the college process is like, what the process is like for an artist to try to wrangle his demons as his girlfriends cheat on him. I would know nothing about this. And, you know, just try to pull from my own life and kind of make allegories. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it autobiographical, or is that what we're talking about here?
This is my memoir, Girls and the Demons Deal. But I also wrote it because when I was at the New School, you know, I go all the way to college. I'm in like the business of acting class at Eugene Land College. They put in a VHS, right? And it's Colin Firth and the Irish actor, you know, famous Irish actor. And it's like inside the actor's studio, and James Lipton is asking him questions. And then he's basically like, well, I was like living in a sewer, right? And then I was like pumping gas for the poo goes in it. And so then someone was like, you want to be a movie, right? So I was like in Drinking Code, Minority Report. And then like I was like in a pile of teenagers. And then someone was like, do you want to do a movie called Total Recall? And it's like, do you not understand that this is a retarded fuckboy? Why are we watching it? Like, he just stumbles through life. Everything happens to him. He said nothing about acting. He was just like being tapped on the shoulder constantly, being a retarded person. Colin Firth is a legally retarded person. So I was like, let's put in an accurate portrayal of what it's like to be someone trying to be an artist, you know? So that's kind of where I want to, you know, how many MFA, how many Masters of Fine Art get acting degrees from Juilliard every semester? And then like how many people are ordained in a Diddy party to actually, you know, make it in Hollywood? So like there's a little discrepancy there that.
Yeah, this isn't about talent.
What do you mean?
This is that you know, I mean, that's not the criteria that we, you know, you and I both lived in LA long enough to know that's part of it, right? Like anyone can read the lines, like read the lines, read them again, read them like you're sad, read them like you're really sad, you know, and then, but it's like, who's connected in that network? Who's willing to go an extra step? Who's willing to do this or that, you know? I mean, I knew plenty of Hollywood scumbags that were the type that would, you know, push somebody over the line and over, you know, make them, put them in a situation where they feel uncomfortable. And I never understood, I don't know, I guess maybe you'd have to really want it to be like an actor or actress to compromise yourself that way. But when you were coming up in comedy though, would you see with that? I mean, because I'm assuming it's pretty much the same thing. You'd like to think it was always just about like who makes the audience laugh, but I'm sure that like anything, that's only part of it, right? Is there just a whole network of, I don't know, gatekeepers?
Yeah, it's like
people standing in your way.
It's just for me, it was coming up in comedy, it's just the bumping was just so vicious and brutal. And I've been
meaning like you're supposed to go up and then you get bumped off of the stage to like tomorrow night or something like that. Or
no, like I always like kind of first come, first serve, like early bird gets the worm. Every open mic, and then, you know, which sometimes are blended with, you know, performers that aren't in the open mic proper, but they've texted the host ahead of time and this and that. It always gets blurry. But I've even hosted shows where like the list is the list. And then some headliner who sometimes does that club does like 60 minutes. And then I'm giving them a light and they're like, fuck you. And it's just like, and then when I've gone into fights with people and it, like, this was insane. This is just clear narcissism. If you think that your soul is worth more than the 60 souls listed on the thing, and that, you know, so it just becomes impossible. So I've done like free shows in New Orleans and other places for years and years. And then just for that to turn like, you know, sometimes headliners will give you like $100. So then where is the point where you go from, you know, from the opener to the, it's not like you're an apprentice plumber, right? It's kind of like a shape-shifting chimera of fame that can kind of come and go. And so you can't, the structure of college is kind of fair, because I did see a lot of people fail out that didn't do their work. And so I like structure. I like where it's like fair. And I like, you come in with your homework and then we all give each other notes on our writing. Like I thought it was fair. But, you know,
yeah,
to be honest, I could have done that with...
You mentioned that in the book. There's the Paul Dano character, the actor who doesn't come in and you are very upset that it's unfair that he gets to miss all this time when attendance is a huge component of the grading criteria. And clearly this guy's not going to be here. You in this book are annoyed by it all. So I would imagine that the comedy world being as inherently and structurally unfair as it is, with all the trappings of Hollywood, and we know how unfair and nepotistic and insane that industry is, that for somebody who appreciates structure, order, and decency, comedy has to be hell for you.
Imagine this, okay? You're in class, and then someone doesn't have to... So the syllabus might say something like attendance. They might even say something about class participation, because class participation shows that you've done the reading, which I always did. I'm a good boy. I'm a good student. And then none of the rules apply to this other person who leaves for 6 months and then... or for 6 weeks, and then comes back. And then, you know, even at the final performance, everyone's supposed to get 15 minutes. This person shows up 70 minutes late. And then because they were late, they get to do 35 minutes at the end. Okay? And so even if college thumbs the scale to who's famous, a shape-shifting chimera of fame that comes and goes with smoke and mirror, fame is over fairness at every single level. But I just thought, you know, you put your head down, you work hard, and you kind of stay on your own yoga mat, and you don't look at how stretchy and flexible and beautiful everyone else is. You got to just mind your business. And it can be extremely disheartening, you know. And speaking of movies, you know, Dr. Rainer Fulmich is in jail right now for making a Nuremberg Level 2, for kind of signaling that he saw clear Nuremberg violations with the COVID scandemic. And now in response to that, the Vanderbilt family is making another Nuremberg just to make sure that a certain group is the victims. Like the Nuremberg from the Nazis, right? So we're getting Vanderbilt family is making another Nuremberg.
So, great.
While all the legal lessons from Nuremberg are known and studied by generations of lawyers, doesn't matter, because the lesson of Nuremberg is that a certain group is the victim, and that's what you really need to know. You know, World War II ended 80 years ago, and there are 168 Holocaust museums, brick and mortar, full-salaried Holocaust museums. There are
it's an industry.
There's 500 blockbuster films already about the Holocaust. And, you know, today, a certain group is committing a genocide of their neighbors. And you can't call it a Holocaust because this group has trademarked that term for their suffering. So it's like, you know, you got to just put that a trademark, you know.
Well, it's kind of like saying when Pat Riley trademarked three-peat, you know. Back with the Lakers, you know, Netanyahu is gonna trademark Holocaust 2 Electric Boogaloo for and make sure he gets paid on that every time it's played.
Yeah, and then the Vanderbilt family licensed that for him for another blockbuster movie. It's like saying, like, you know, two people, like, hey man, you hit my car. No, no, no. How dare you say that? My grandpa died in a car accident 80 years ago. No, no.
You never hit your car.
Wait a minute. You hit my car. No, no, no. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Are you a vehicular manslaughter denier? Because there are 168 museums and 500 movies showing that I'm the victim here. Wait, you just ran over my dad, my mom, my cousin. You're snuffing out everyone who lives in the whole Glendale Strip.
I have questions about the vehicular manslaughter numbers.
Yeah. Well, that sounds very anti-Buick to me. That sounds anti-Buick.
Well, you take that up with the Red Cross when they officially reclassified it in the early 90s and 1.5 million, but really, as they said, it's probably more like 271,000. We all know.
Well, Ole Demigod can talk more about that. That's not my lane. I'm staying on my own yoga mat.
That German accent, of yours, you better be careful when you start talking about the juice. Because they may round you up like they are in Germany. They are putting people in prison for wrong think. They are busting people like C.J. Hopkins for writing, putting swastikas on the book cover of his book, The New Normal. So we've seen the authoritarian crackdown in the homeland recently.
Yeah, I mean, and Dr. Rainer Fulmich was doing the same thing, seeing how these Gestapo tactics, these hidden hand tactics, were being used in the COVID thing. No, 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 you can't draw that parallel because you're kind of revealing our playbook. So let's go back 80 years ago and explain who the real victims are. It's like, well, no, there's other things that have happened. You can't live in the past of like the, it's like a sad person, like the, you know, doing like talking about their high school football days. It's like, no, no, no. There's things happening right now that we have to deal with. You can't just live in the past in this doom loop. You got to move on, you know? Sure, bad things happen to people. And, you know, but yeah. Anyway, I was a German exchange student.
I know. I know you were. And it sort of goes into it a little bit in the book. I mean, you and I know some of this because you and I have talked over the years about your experience. But what was the German exchange student? How was that scenario? Because I don't think I ever knew anybody who ever went anywhere in an exchange program. But I mean, I knew about them. I just didn't have any personal experience. What was yours like?
Well, first they came to my house in like October of 2002, and he was a very austere German man, and he came, let's call him Jock, okay? I've said his full name on other podcasts, and I probably shouldn't do that. The first thing we noticed was like, we were like, hey, you know, you can use the shower whenever you want. And he's like, why should I? I showered like 4 or 5 days ago. And then like he took over my room and I was sleeping in the basement. And so we had to like, when I had to go up for like clothes or socks or underwear, you know, type of thing, it like smelled like terribly. And we were like, well, you know, here's the shower. And he's like, I don't need to. It's like, okay, but here's the shower. I don't want to make a faux pas, but like use it, please. And then when I went over there, that's the one rule they said. They said, Wasser ist teuer. So they're like, water is very expensive, you know, so don't shower every day. That was one of the things. And I that's the only rule I disobeyed. But I was like, for 20 seconds got wet. Then I lathered up. Then for 20 more seconds, then I rinsed off, because the girls were very attractive and some of them were into me. And if you think I'm going in with stinky britches to see these foxy broads, you got another thing coming, my friend. I started, my German was okay when I was, you know, training at New Jersey Public School for 2 years before. But boy, when I saw those girls, I started conjugating my verbs, if you know what I'm talking about, you know?
I know what you're saying. but you had no chance with the purebred French broad, did you?
Well, there was a girl in my high school who, you know, over lunch, Jock just explained to me that I had no chance with her. And I was like, no, I got a crush on her. And he's like, oh, she will not go for you. And I was like, what do you mean you've never met her? And then he said, well, she's like pure French. And I was like, what? like, it didn't make sense. I was like, okay, like, yeah, she's from France. I'm from America. You're from Germany. What are you talking about? People like each other. And then, you know, have you ever seen Beauty and the Beast? Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And then he's like, no, but she's like pure French, like 100% French. And I was like, okay, what are you saying? And he's like, I don't know. Like, it would. And then he goes, you're like a mutt blood. Because my dad is German-Irish, my mom's Italian, and at the time I thought it was part Native American too. And I was like, what? So like in his mind, like she was like a Ferrari and my semen was like 52 octane gasoline. And he was pretty convinced that if we bred, we would make a series of web-fingered retard babies, was like basically what he was saying. Like, we're, but like, she's like, you're like genetically inferior. What do you mean? And so I was like, I think your people tried some of that bullshit before. It didn't really work out for you, did it? And then literally, that was like our last conversation other than when's class, when's breakfast, literally. So the last month he was at my house, we did not talk. Then I went over his house. Literally, we did not talk. It was like crickets over breakfast. But then I was like super popular in the high school. So it was like, and then he was, and then I was like fraternizing with like the most beautiful girl in his high school. And I remember I was looking up and he was like at the second floor of the quad. I was like in the middle of the quad canoodling with this, like literally the hottest girl in his high school. And he was like looking down at me with these sinister, with his hands ringing. And he was like, you know, and because he got no action in Jersey and he got no act, none of the girls like even talked to him. They talked to him less than I did. And I live with the kid. So like, I was like, man, you know, thank God I'm funny. And it also seemed like the sort of more liberal arts education in America was like superpowers in Germany because they were so austere. I remember they were telling us about, you know, it's not uncommon for there to be nude beaches. There was like, this was an assembly of like all of the people, like all the German kids, all the American kids, all the professors. And it was like, we were like greeted like the Beatles when we showed up to the German high school. Cause they were, it was like 200 kids that were sick of each other. They'd known each other since they were zero. And now they're 15 and they're sick of each other. So when 10 American kids came to a 200 kid German high school in Clayfield, Germany, it was like crazy. So there was all like the whole school practically was in this building. And they were explaining that, you know, sometimes there's naked people at beaches and don't be bashful about that. That's just our culture here, blah, blah, blah. And so I just asked, like, is there any fishing opportunities? Because I was like, you know, did a lot of trout fishing in New Jersey when I was growing up. And then I just made this one joke. I was like, yeah, but you probably shouldn't trout fish at the nude beach or you could have a terrible injury. And I killed so hard. And then like I noticed like, oh, okay, this is pretty easy here. That's a pretty easy joke in Jersey. And then like I was super popular in the German high school and it completely enraged him.
That's where you got it.
You cracked
a joke like and won the crowd in high school and then you've been chasing. I get it.
I've been chasing
the laughter dragon ever since.
Yeah, and things went well. Things didn't go well. I hosted the Battle of the Bands, and that went terrible. But then I also ran the sketch group, and then I went on to Upright Citizens Brigade, and I went all through the levels there. I was a very accomplished improv guy. So, yeah, it's like I've always known that the best part of my personality is I'm pretty funny and I'm pretty good at writing. So I've kind of pursued those arts only to be so horrified by the vicious nepotism and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, welcome to, but then again, you know, that's kind of a good lesson for life because as soon as you get into, you go through school, you're told like work hard, do the right thing, then, and you know, work your way up and you know, you'll be successful. And then you watch assholes, psychopaths, and scumbags leapfrog past you in the corporate ladder because you're nice or doing it one way. And it feels extremely unfair. And what I learned once I went into corporate world was that there are no rules. Like, you think there's rules. I thought that I needed to get a job, work there for a long, long time. And if I did well, then they would make me like the manager or something like that. After I knew what I was doing, prove that I knew what I was doing, they'd see that and then they would make me manager. I got, and I didn't ever want to be manager, but I remember thinking that that was the process. I remember starting in new home sales, getting off to like a really hot start, selling a shitload. They came to me within the first 2 months of me working in the business. I had never worked in the business before. Within 2 months, asked me if I would be the manager. And I was like, I'm unqualified. They're like, yeah, it's not like that. Like, it's okay. You'll figure it out. And I was like, wait, you don't have to know anything? And they're like, no, you just, we'll just say you're the manager. I'm like, but I would be overseeing people with 20 years of experience. They know I don't know anything. They go, it doesn't matter. I was like, well, so I remember having this revelation that like, this idea in my head that like there's a chain of command, or there's a chain of like, oh, you start at the bottom, you work hard, you work your way up. There's other people, they started at the bottom, they work hard, they work their way up. And then you get in there and you realize whoever's buddies, whoever goes drinking with the manager, they're going straight to the top, not you. Like, if that's what your thing is, like, it's totally unfair, whether you're in the corporate world or whether you're doing comedy shows or whatever. So I connected with your, you know, I mean, I connected with the parts of the book that are like where your character, let's just say, you know, is just frustrated by the injustice and inherent fucked up nature of it all. I get it. So,
yeah. And if we're in school for the degree, okay, and the degree is to get a job, and someone like, I don't know, let's pull a name out of the hat. Paul Dano had been a movie star since he was 15, and then he leaves school to go be a movie star. He should not get the credit because by the syllabus, he failed. But what I realized was if the teacher has a crush on you, none of that matters. And it's, and then I, for leaving during, when the class was supposed to end, was docs more points because I did my thing. And then I was, you know, ready to leave when my dad showed up in his Buick. And then, but I was the teacher, I walked out of the room and she goes, rude, you know? And it's like, okay, I can't give you a lecture about narcissism right now. I'm just going to leave. And then I got a B minus. And but it's like, I also was in the library because Eugene Land College didn't have a library at that time. So we had to go to NYU, which is like four blocks south of us, or eight blocks south. And I ran into Haley Joel Osment. And I go, what are you in school for? And he goes, acting. And he was in The Sixth Sense and he already has an acting agent. You're done. You don't need to be in school for 4 years to get an agent, to get jobs as an actor when you have agent and jobs as an actor, right? Mr. Dano, I don't know what he was in school for, maybe philosophy, something like that, maybe French poetry. I'm not sure what his track was. But it's like, if the thing is to get the degree, at least don't give someone the degree when they play hooky for 6 weeks. But you play hooky for 6 weeks and you still get it. It's like, give me my loser coupon. Like, what are we doing here? You know?
We're playing real life. Where the rules are written in pencil and it's not fair, and you're made to see that. You're made to see the injustice of it. It's rubbed in your face. And then you have to go on about your life and try to like figure out, like make a calculation, like how much of this is bullshit and I'm going to play the game, and how much of this is, I remember just it. My experiences with corporate world were always not good. There's always some inherent unfairness kind of built into the system. I interviewed for the what turned out to be the worst job I ever had in my life, which was commercial real estate. And I interviewed 7 different times for the same company. And on the 7th interview, they brought me in and my attitude had changed. Probably the reason why it turned out to be such a bad job. That with the president just sat me down and said, all right, I just have a couple more questions. And I just said, I have to stop you. Like, before you even start, I said, either hire me right this second or I'm walking out the fucking door. no more questions or anything like that. And he laughed and he goes, what took you so long? And I was like, is that,
so he was,
is that what we're doing?
Testing you.
Is that
to,
what we're doing?
If
we're
you trying, know that
we're trying yes. to see if we can push me into a frustration where I walk in and tell my potential future boss to fucking hire me or I'm walking out the door. That's the baseline where we're starting. I didn't last 7 months in that job. It was the worst job I ever had. It was the only job I've ever had where I literally stood up in the middle of the office, a cube farm, and screamed at a woman to shut her effing mouth. Or I was going to come over there and shut it for her. And I was like, who have I turned into? Like, and she, and by the way, for the record, she 150% had it coming to her. So it was one of those things where I was just like, dude, if this is the real world, I'm not interested. And Eric, I'll be honest, that the I'll never forget this moment in that job was that I had gone out. I'd talk about a perspective changer for me. I'd gone out to lunch, and in this building was in a like a 7-story high rise that had a lobby with elevators. I'm coming, I'm walking right back, I'm walking into the front lobby to get in the elevator to go up to the to our office, and I see the guy mopping the floor. And I think to myself, now that guy's got it figured out. He's got nobody up his ass. He's got nobody telling him he's doing it wrong. He's not nobody telling him where's the, you know, you know, where's the data? Where's the sales? Where's this? He doesn't have five bosses screaming at him. And I thought, you know what? If I'm envying the guy mopping the floors, I've made a tremendous vocational error and I need to be somewhere else. And so I don't know what that was in your life for you, but for me, that was a turning point in my life where I realized that like, it's more than just a paycheck. Like I have to live this life as well. It's not just about getting paid every 2 weeks and going, oh, I'll just suck it up for the time in between those paychecks. Like, fuck that. That's no way to live. I don't want to do that. And I had to like get honest with myself about like what makes me happy. Like, so what was that for you? Because you've been through it. You've been through the ringer. You've been in New York. You've been in LA. You've been in New Orleans. Like, you've fought the battles in the comedy world and the writing world. Like, what was it for you that, like, made you question, like, is this something that I actually want to do? Or should I go, you know, I mean, or should I be selling fucking snorkels at the beach and somewhere else?
Yeah, I don't know if we talked about this before. I think maybe on my podcast. But, yeah, I was working at 19 Entertainment in the penthouse of 9000 West Sunset. And like, I worked my way up in reality TV where, cause I was an intern at Comedy Central at the New School. And I had like 9 internships. I worked on Wayne-y Days with David Wayne and like the state people from MTV. They had like a web series and I had like really good credentials. So then I worked on Amazing Race and Shark Tank, and I landed at this show called If I Can Dream, which was Hulu's first reality show. And I had told, I really impressed them because I would always stay after my shift. The shifts were these brutal 24-hour shifts where we're basically surveilling these Hollywood hopeful kids. We rigged the house kind of like a Big Brother house. So we were surveilling them 24 hours from this penthouse corporate office. And I would, so my shift was like from 6 a.m. to 4 for 1 week. And then the next week it was 2 p.m. to 10. Then the next week it was 10 p.m. to mid. So it was like absolutely crazy making the sleep disruption. But I would even stay after, because sometimes I like was jet lagged. So I would stay after or before to watch the edits, because that's where the actual room was happening. And so I really impressed the creative story producer, and I realized that being in a story producing role is the only way I can kind of get my writing out in the reality show world. And it was late at night, and maybe the story producer was delirious too, but he let slip. He's like, I heard about Bryan Singer's house last night. And I was like, oh yeah. And he's like, yeah, for his party, he had like 12 and 13 year old naked boys in his pool for like an ornament. And I was like, huh, what? Like, you know, I had been sleep deprived for a month, and I was like, I'm sorry. It was almost like my German exchange student, like, oh, she's like purebred. I was like, what? Like, what? Like, it like took a minute to translate what they were saying.
Yeah, you know, the boys, and, the children over at Brian Singer's house, you know, come on, like, as you do.
You know, the naked boys for the ornament for the pool party? And I was like,
right.
What? You know? And the story producer comes out, was a Freemason, and he and Brian Singer's a Freemason, and that's how I knew about that. They're just like, all the people in that neighborhood had all these like mansions and whatever, whatever. That's how it is. So I said to him, I go, so when you found out about this, like, you called the SWAT team, and then the pedo SWAT team right. went over his house and shot all the kitty fiddlers dead, right? And he looks at me, he goes, I don't think that's how it works. Anyway, so this scene, what we're going to do is they go in the burger place first, and then they're going to turn right. And I was like, what? Well. So then my next paycheck was like three paychecks. Right? And really? So I, yeah, I'm not joking. And then I went to the line producer because I'm such a good boy. And if I was later told if I didn't, they would have kept it. So I went to the line producer and I said, I think there's been a mistake. And then they changed it back to my original salary. Right. And I was like you at that office, give me the job or I'm walking. They gave me the raise and saw what I would do. Just beta testing slaves, because rich people that have all the money, what can you buy? You buy people, you buy influence, you buy this. You saw, like, they let me know certain things, and then we're like, here's money. Whoops. And that was like a real, yeah. And then later the show ended abruptly. And then like, I was like out on my ass again between reality shows. Like I was before, just cast it out. And I wonder if I never said anything, if I would have just slipped into another thing. Cause now I'm in this little secret club, you know what I mean? And, but I was like, this is all bullshit. So I just need to spend all my time on stand-up, you know? And then I went to grad school because one of the people that I was working on one of the shows with was a nice lady. And she said, well, I got to be a story producer from school. And I was like, I like school, so I'll go back there because, you know, this world is fair and a meritocracy. And that's a lot of the book is me in grad academia. School. But I actually loved my time at UNO because I'm really good at screenwriting. If you think Girls and the Demon's Deal is fun and entertaining, I'm actually just way better at screenwriting. It's just because it was my discipline. And so, you know, but it's like being a screenwriter is kind of like being an architect, where like I have the blueprints of these fantasy buildings that would change the skyline of the world. But without financing hitting a blueprint, you're just, you know, someone with silly drawings, you know? So it's a mad world. But I mean, how else are you gonna not go crazy if you have a demon in your head and you try to be a good boy doing everything you're supposed to?
I believe this book will be used as evidence against you at your trial at some point. Yes, for sure. That's what you're asking.
Yeah. Speaking of good boys, my publisher, Brandon Thomas. So you always knew I was kind of, what gave you the hint that I was crazy? Like we've been friends for like 4 years now or something like that. But I think you kind of figured it out early.
Yeah. When did I know that you were insane? Oh, let's say it's a fun kind of crazy though. It's not like, stabby stabby. It's like, it's inappropriate comedy. It's like there's a line that everyone else sees and you maybe see it too, but you don't have a problem like kind of going off to one side of it a little bit. Which I actually kind of appreciate, to be honest with you, because so many people are concerned about staying within the lines, and I appreciate your ability to be unburdened and do that. So I think you take chances with your comedy, which is good. I think that's a good thing. You could write. I mean, I learned. I'm not a fiction writer or anything like that, but I learned from my business partner when we were doing the sports media, who's a legit professional, well-trained, went to university to become an actor, like who takes the role seriously and things like that. He taught me that when it comes to sitcoms, that the writing style is rhythmic. That there's a verbal pattern to it. There's a la 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 and a la 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 and a la 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 scene. You know, it's this back forth, bam, bam, boom, and then the scene. You know, and if you can write that way, if you understand the flows of this comedic writing, and my partner is spending a lot of time with people who are actual directors of legitimate shows that every single person would recognize. And he's talking to the director of this, and who's explaining to him the whole rhythm of, and then my partner is explaining it to me. And I have, of course, no interest or knowledge of how any of this works. It's just sort of interesting to me. And then after he said that, I've started watching television a little bit differently. I started watching, so you'll notice it with Friends as well. And of course, you know, they put the laugh track in there, but there's a rhythm and a tempo to it. And if you can write that way, which is not normal writing, and it's not the way actual human beings talk to each other or anything like that, it's a very specialized skill. And if you've got it and you can play the game, then you can work in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, you know, but I ran into Daniele Bolelli, and he was always just telling me that, like, universities are dead, and, like, you're only relevant as an artist if you chop your own path in the woods. Like, you know, I really think that a show like Stranger Things kind of, like, broke a mold, and that's why it was so successful. So there is, like, a pattern of, you know, sort of hacky, formulaic sitcom writing, which has its place in the world. But I was always like, whatever that line is, like you were saying, like you can push that way over the edge and actually get laughs. Cause like, you know, just from coming from stand-up, there's some people that are like, you know, do jokes about airline peanuts, or there was like 30 years in the 90s where every Australian comedian he fought a shark, he got drunk, and there was like a family drama. Like there was like a formula to how they did stand up. It was like fight with an animal, you know, nature, family. That like there was like a formula. Yeah. And so I was always like, what is the point of your life if you're going to follow a formula of something else? Like, you know, screenwriting format is one thing, but then it's like you can paint all sorts of in and out the lines of that. Like there are the people that can play jazz, and then there are the people that can put a kazoo in their ass while they're playing jazz. It's like, that's all music, baby.
Well, Girls and the Demons Deal is essentially your kazoo up the ass moment, and I appreciate it. So I'm glad you did it. But yeah, you get a lot more latitude when it comes to like maybe the screenwriting. I think you could take some chances, especially now where the barriers to entry in terms of getting things made is lower than it's ever been, in terms of getting access to high quality equipment and editing and things like that, and having the ability to put it on a platform and get visibility like YouTube or Rumble or someplace like that. And it's not a full Hollywood release, but when we put out Barum World, the criteria for raising money for it was that it was designed to be a free movie in the end, but there's no one correct way to do it now, which is nice, because back in the old days you had to fuck Harvey Weinstein if you wanted to get your project made, and now you don't have to, but you still, you know, obviously the infrastructure of Hollywood still remains, but it's just that there's those barriers to entry, it feels like they've been lowered. I mean, do you still have friends in Hollywood that are working? Like, what's their experience after 4 years of the COVID insanity and everything that comes along with that? Like, what are they doing? Are they plotting their exit from Hollywood like everyone else, or are they just kind of stuck?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because I was alleging to one of my mentors who is in my book, and I talk about, and she like told me to get my master in screenwriting, and she's still in Hollywood, and I go, how's your life? And she's, you know, worked on The Bachelor since it started, and she basically told me, you know, I'm in hell. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she goes, well, for like I have all the of my own screenplays, and I'm stuck on a Bachelor TV show where for 30 years I've been cutting bimbos, doing sound bites of them saying, I'm here to find love, I'm not here to make friends. That's been my life for 30 years. I'm in hell.
I'm here for the right reasons.
So, you know, it's like you can get to the top of story producing reality shows. And if you're at the tippy top, you're in hell because you're doing the same show. But that's like a successful career. A lot of people, you know, I was listening to, there was this sitcom in the 80s called Wings. And I was listening to the producer of that talk, and he was like, we just were over the moon for five seasons of Wings. And then when Wings ended, we didn't work for 10 years. And so like, that's a, you know, the whole production company. And you have to understand that when you're a production company, it's like four people that pitch a TV show, they greenlight a TV show, they hire 60 people when they're running five seasons of Wings, when they, when the show gets canceled, they go back to three people and they go around pitching again. So I was always like, how do I be one of the three? You know? So, and then it's like, oh, get an advanced degree. I could do that, you know? But a lot of it's luck. A lot of it's who you know. A lot of it's relationships. And, you know, if you don't have a trust fund where you can be at, in the cities, like if you're not in Santa Monica or Soho, you know, taking the meetings, doing the networking, with the, I mean, how, what are you going to do? You're either plucked from obscurity. Like I started this thing. What's his name? Colin Firth, you know, or Farrell, maybe Colin Farrell, whoever dated Britney Spears. Anyway, that stupid fuckboy.
Oh, Colin Farrell.
Farrell, not Firth. I apologize. You know, you won't be a movie. That's literally how it is. So like, you know, it's just, You gotta make your own luck, and you gotta like not go crazy in the nepotism.
I watched my buddy made a movie. He and his brother wrote this screenplay. He and I had been working as bank tellers at Wells Fargo in Newport Beach. This was like in '92. It was a million years ago. And one day I wasn't working, but he was, and he got robbed by an old man. Like, honest to God, guy pulled a gun on him and everything at the bank. And after that, he wound up having this idea about, like, what if we rob the bank from the inside? You know, what if while this old man was robbing the bank, he foiled our plot where you were going to come in and rob the bank and pretend like you didn't work there? And he had this whole, like, plot for it. So he wrote this screenplay and raised $7 million and turned it into a movie. It's called Scorched. You can find it. It's like a real movie with Woody Harrelson and John Cleese and Rachel Lee Cook and Alicia Silverstone and all these people. And I watched him make it. I was on set watching them film his scene with Rachel Lee Cook and all that. And I'm laughing because I'm meeting one of the characters on the, who's Dave Krumholtz, who's like an actor. He's like a legit actor now. He's playing this character, but the character's based on me. And the character's based on us, like when we were roommates, just like laughing, like sitting on the beach, and I'm just laughing, like, oh, there should be like a dog rental, you know, where you could rent puppies, and then we could use puppies to pick up chicks and things like that. And so, and anyway, these asinine conversations wind up in the script. And then eventually on screen in the movie. And so you see these things happen. And I asked my friend, like, how did it all happen? And in retrospect, looking back, there were so many things that had to go right. And they had to get lucky. Obviously, they had a good script. But even outside of that, the thing started and stopped a few times until the right people came in with money. And I thought, how do you even get anything made? And he never made anything after that. And he tried. And so you're right about the thing with Wings, you know, like sometimes it's like, oh, I got this great show and it, you know, it's a home run. It'd be like winning. It's like winning the first time you place a sports bet in Vegas. Like it's the worst thing that could ever happen to you is to have success immediately. Cause then you think, oh, this is normal. This is how it always is. Right. But how many Hollywood stories do you hear of people that you know who have just been, you know, next year is going to be the year, right? It's a sunk cost. I've already been trying 25 years. Next year is going to be the year where I'm going to sell the script or I'm going to make it big. Or it's just like, it there's no guarantee that that's ever going to happen. It's the most frustrating business because you can put all the time and energy and you would have had a fucking PhD anywhere else. Instead, you're still waiting tables at Barney's Beanery, hoping that you get a call back to some shit commercial that you didn't even want in anyway, you know?
Yeah. And even when you do get a PhD and you do everything right, you're Andy Wakefield and you get kicked out for making a peer reviewed paper, right. who now I'm friends with. And
He's like, great. Geez. Yeah, isn't he nice?
Oh, dude, he was on my podcast. He's so inspiring. What a great guy, Andy Wakefield.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the roughest part. I mean, it's just speaking of getting projects done, speaking of getting this book done. Brandon and I almost had a falling out because he found out I was crazy. And what happened was we had finished the one that came out has 35 chapters, right? So you can learn all about my Aunt Jenny's awful vagina up to the chapter 35.
Oh yeah, early front runner for chapter name of the year, chapter 3, My Aunt Jennifer's Awful Vagina Killed a Doctor.
That's a true story.
It's gotta be in contention. I read the chapter. So listen,
yeah, it's a two pager that's a banger right there.
Is this the book for me? Well, do you like books with chapters called My Aunt Jennifer's Awful Vagina Killed a Doctor? Because if you do, have we got the book for you. It's called Girls and the Demon's Deal by Eric Hollerbach.
And when you read the chapter, is it very clear that my Aunt Jenny's awful vagina killed a doctor? Don't I make it that's exactly what happened?
You know, surprisingly, yes, as a matter of fact. And you read the title to the chapter and you think, well, I'll be the judge of that.
I know. You're like, how could that possibly happen? That was the murder weapon. Oh. That's what happened. So we had a version that was like 52 chapters. And I got there's a hardcover, paperback, e-Kindle version and the audiobook. So those are the deliverables. I was like 30 chapters in recording the audiobook on the version of this book that had like 50 or 52 chapters. I can't remember. So I was like, I delivered it. 3 months go by. I'm 30 chapters into reading the audiobook. And then also when you read the audiobook, you have to like, you know, sometimes I misread or I cough or whatever. So I was like, even like clipping those down. So it was like a long process. So one night, I get a call and then he's like, hey man, we got to cut some chapters, you know? And I was like, oh, and it was like 15 or 16 chapters. And I was like, well, no, we're not doing that. And like, you know, there was also stuff about, we had to change some names and we had to get some photo credits and so I was like, Why are you being a bitch? Why are you being a bitch? Like you're worried you'll get sued? I'll get sued. I don't give a fuck. I'll go to court every day for this book. I will martyr myself for my own book. Like, and I was just kind of going crazy because it's like, I've been working on this book. Like some of the chapters, like this book is like 20 years in the making, right? So it's like, I birthed this baby out of my canvas womb. And then, you know, he's like, no, we're gonna chop this baby a third off its head. And I was like, the fuck we are. And also, you know, so then I was kind of like in a tizzy and I was kind of like, well, let's like pause for a day. And then they came back and they're like, don't go. It's two books, one book about your personal life. But then you wrote all these essays about show business. That's another book. And then I was like, OK, you're right. OK, like, you know, but then there was also like a little personality thing. I kind of, you know, Brandon, he's just like such a positive person. And I thought he suffered a little bit from toxic positivity. You know, I kind of thought he was maybe not a real person, like a realist or like down to earth. He had a little toxic positivity. And then I realized that I'm a crazy person with a demon in my head. So like, you know what I mean? Maybe I'm just like a grumpy bumpkin. And he's like just a sweet, sweet boy. And so then I was like, oh, you're just a nice person. Like, you know what I mean? And so, you know, we're very different yes. people.
He's a but very nice person. He's overly nice. He's one of the most positive people I've Brandon Thomas, Expanding Realities podcast. Yeah. One of the most positive people. I talked to
the
him
publisher
last week
of this book.
We the publisher of the book. Yeah, they from Redigional Publishing. That's their company. Ridiculously uh-huh. Original. So he and I talk from time to time. He's fantastically positive, and you are, you know, borderline institutionalized. You know what I mean? And so the two of you guys, together, it could be. I mean, you found a way to meet in the middle. So am I correct in assuming that there's a part two to this coming?
There is a part two. It's probably like 3 years away, but one of the things that landed on the cutting room floor was a whole chapter about Jay Leno being a hoarder, and basically, you know, he has 300. So just brief cliff notes about this. People don't know. Rodney Dangerfield gave Jay Leno every dollar he's ever had. Dangerfield's Jay Leno has $600 million and a car collection that he continues to injure himself on because he's a virile man. And so Dangerfield's in New York City went bankrupt during COVID, and I text them all the time. Did Jay Leno try to help financially Dangerfield's get rebooted? Because Jay Leno is such a cheap person, he would not pay rent. He would live in the storage closet of Dangerfield's club, and then he'd live rent-free in Dangerfield's different houses and apartments. He would refuse to pay rent. And now, luckily, if you want to learn how to be a stand-up, Jay Leno's teaching classes for only $500, right? So do you see how narcissism doesn't end? So for $500, because Jay Leno won't fall out of his pocket to raise the community that gave him everything he's ever had in life, specifically Rodney Dangerfield. If you've never heard of Rodney Dangerfield, you would never know about Jay Leno. I guarantee this. So, you know, I wrote articles about Jay Leno. I wrote articles about Louis C.K.'s business model, Pig Newton putting stuff online, charging $5, but and how disruptive that was to the industry, and how the New York Times then went after him. So a lot of like articles that you can't really get anywhere else, but it's like, oh, these are showbiz articles. This is like a personal life. And then I have like another one coming out that's literally like a manual of show business of how it really works. This is like the spiritual end of it. And then the other one is like a really practical, like could be taught in a college setting.
Yeah.
But they're like, it's two books. And I was like, okay.
When I lived in South Bay, I remember one night, Sunday night, I was walking down the main street, and I see this white Lamborghini Countach, 1989, 25th anniversary, old school, make a U-turn and pull in right in front of me, like pull right in front of this place as I'm walking down the sidewalk, and I'm with these girls, and I said, I bet you $1 million Jay Leno gets out of that Lamborghini. And they laughed. Door opens up. Jay Leno gets out. She goes, how did you know that? I said, because he plays every Sunday at the Hermosa Comedy Store. Small place. Probably fit 150 people in there maximum. And he'd play every Sunday while doing the Tonight Show. And I know this was while he was doing the Tonight Show, because they filmed a segment of the Tonight Show at the restaurant where I was bartending, and I got to see like how the sausage was made, that like the man on the street interview is like, oh, let's just go interview all these nice people that are here just sitting out at this restaurant on a sunny day here in beautiful Hermosa Beach, having food. Let's ask them questions. It's like a remote, you know, like there's a guy with a microphone, but Jay Leno's on the screen. Everybody's drinking Budweiser. Why is that? Because the Bud rep is off camera and has bought beer for everybody in the entire bar, so that everybody's drinking Budweiser when the Jay Leno cameras come through and do all that. So all that's coordinated. All the man on the street people that they're interviewing are all working for Budweiser. Everything about the entire thing was staged, rigged, and fake. And I'm watching it going,
Interesting. I mean, I kind of knew it inherently, but like, you don't even need to fake this. Like, we, you know, you could have asked these other actual customers who I knew, they would have been fun to play along with, but nothing about it was left to chance. And I remember thinking, this is supposed to be the spontaneous part of the Tonight Show, where it's just man on the street, and every aspect of it was fake and controlled. And by the way, Jay Leno tried to hit on the girls I was walking down the street with. He got out, oh, hey, it's me, the whole thing. Oh yeah, let me give you, good to be the king, he said as he's hugging the girls or anything. I was like, just watching him. So yeah.
Yeah, we know, but Jay. He just did a podcast circuit, and he's playing victim, wheeling around his wife who's 80, you know, with dementia. And he's like, you know, I'm the good husband with a wife with dementia. Meanwhile, he's hitting on girls in Hermosa, you know, whatever. He's a scum. He's disgusting. Jay Leno is a toxic hoarder. Won't have a dime knock out of. Listen, Dangerfield's put him up in his house. Here, there's turkey salad in the fridge. Play my club. Sleep in the closet. You shouldn't have to spend a dime. Do you think he would learn that behavior and then not charge $500 for his stand-up class?
Didn't Rodney Dangerfield not make it until he was in his mid-40s?
Oh, yeah. He was doing, he was a door-to-door aluminum siding salesman. But he always, for a sales tactic to sell aluminum siding or roofing work and stuff like that, he had this joke book. And so when HBO first gave him a special, he recorded an hour. And then the next month he called them up and he goes, when can I do that again? And they go, well, you have to build another hour. And he's like, yeah, I know. So when can we do that again? And they're like, you have another hour of material? And he's like, yeah. And so then he does another, and then the next month he calls, he goes, when are we going to do that again? And they go, there's no way you can, he's like, do you want a bet? Hey, I got no respect in this, but he does it again. He did like 6 hours in like 3 years, because as a salesman, he had like notebook, like thick, all he had to do was put it together. Oh, I used that one, I didn't use this one. He had 20 notebooks when Hollywood came calling. You know, so that does give me hope.
What was the reputation of Rodney Dangerfield? Did he have a good rep?
Amazing. He would he would fly his openers in his private jet. He would give them $30,000 cash, but they had to go play casino with him, and then they would do a show. He would do a residency and he'd be like, come on, come in. And then he would have like a bathrobe and like accidentally on purpose have his balls fall out of his bathrobe. Like, he was a crazy person, but he surrounded himself with comics. And he's like, you know, after he got divorced and he got taken for half, you know, let's say he had, you know, 40 million, he got taken for 20. He spent the other 20 on his friends very lavishly in his openers, very lavishly. I have not heard one word about this behavior from Jay Leno. Not one word ever. And trust me, I know people who know people. Not once ever. But like, you know, but you hear like Mark Norman would go around New Orleans when I lived there, get drunk with the open micers, and he was like the best. Jerry Seinfeld would take a plane in, plane out, and you were not allowed to look. The openers, Mark Norman in the green room wasn't allowed to look or talk at him.
That's so dumb. Do you imagine thinking
not
that you're so special that people can't look at you? I heard that Steve Harvey did that too, from like Family Feud. Steve Harvey, don't look at me. Don't you be looking at me.
Yeah.
Don't you make eye contact with Steve Harvey now. You hear that? When you go out there, don't you make eye contact with him.
Well, I think, there's two sides to that story. To that story. Maybe people were, you know, chatty hens were coming over his cubicle and he was screaming at them and they deserved every word of what he said to them. I don't know. There's two sides to that story.
It's true.
You know, you do have to prepare as a comic. And if he's in his green room looking at the notes of Family Feud and people won't stop knocking on his door, I could see how that's annoying. Because, you know, but
yeah.
I'm not sure about that situation.
Trying to figure out how he can incorporate some joke in so that he can hug some white woman with big tits on the Family Feud.
Well, that's a good scam. Did that lady at the cubicle deserve the lady you yelled at the cubicle, did she deserve it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the first time I've ever, it's first time I've ever yelled at a woman, and I yelled at her twice. Yeah. I told her, I literally turned at her one time and I said, mind your own fucking business in front of everybody in the entire office. It was like, and no, she was the secretary from Ferris Bueller's. Picture that lady. Oh, Ed, you look like Dirty Harry just then. That lady from Ferris Bueller. That was the equivalent of the lady that I screamed at on two different occasions who had it coming to her. You know, the type of person who celebrated that she had jury duty so she could be out of the office and fucking up somebody else's life. You know, that type of person. So,
yeah, that's great.
I get it, man.
Eric, well, you're the best. Mm-hmm. Still crazy, but I love you to death. I wouldn't have you any other way. Let's wrap up. Tell everybody where they can find this book and how they can support you and how they can keep up to date with everything that you're working on.
Yeah, well, you can go to my name, erichollerbach.com. I put out 3 stand-up specials for free on YouTube, Conspiracies and Dick Jokes, Fart Porn and Beer Hall, and It's a Medical Device. You know, and you can go to erichollerbach.com, click Eric's book, and get this. And, you know, it's about good times, bad times, how a vagina killed a doctor. And no matter what happens, you know, you can gather your demons too, strap them to a sled, mush them in a positive direction. But you'll need a star to guide you, one that shines bright, high over the mountain you must climb, always out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
That's
Eric Hollerbach, everybody. Go out there and buy his book and support his work. And if you want to connect with me, you can go to macroaggressions.io. It's easy to do. And if you like this episode, take the additional step of sharing it with your friends right this second. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you again soon.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT. Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.